The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by www.starktruthradio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can read his articles and find out more on robertstark.substack.com.
Robert Stark here. I am joined here with the return of John Arctos. John Arcto, great having you back on.
Thanks so much for having me. You had a line of questions. You had a formal list of questions lined
up. Yeah. So to start things off, if you want to kind of briefly talk about some of the themes on your old Substack blog talked about in the past show, like briefly go over your core themes, and also if you want to mention why you deleted your old Substack blog.
So I originally had a Substack called Anglo-Futurist, which I used the pseudonym John Arcto on that as well. I latched onto the aesthetic of sort of Anglo-Futurism, which was sort of like, it was basically vaporwave with a Union Jack. That's really all you can say about it. And it was sort of co-opted by kind of all kinds of bad actors. I was sort of writing and I didn't really know what it was I kind of believed. And so I, you know, kind of went on sort of long digressions about things. I said some offensive things. I did, because people found out about my Substack, and had done for quite some time, I had to delete it because I was worried that I was going to get doxxed. And I thought if I deleted it then and there, I might escape doxxing. Sadly, that didn't happen. Somebody must have fed me over to the, you know, hope not hate fuckers. But over like the past year, you know, my views have evolved. I'd say I'm less sort of fanatically anti-woke than I used to be. I think partly because of, you know, meeting more people.
To go off on a brief tangent, I think British politics is different because there's more of still like a draconian like hate speech laws and cancel.
I would say, yeah, but
cancel culture kind of thing. But with America,
I'd probably
it's
say
weird.
That blue America is worse than Britain because most of it's sort of the so. I mean, I was never. This was never criminal prosecution. This was just sort of social ostracism.
Right, and I don't think you ever said anything that extreme.
But some of the things I wrote, I regret, and I don't think anymore. Obviously, you can't appease these people because, you know, they'll say everything is, you know, racist, sexist, whatever, all of the ists and phobias. But I think having sort of, you know, met more people, seeing Trump's presidency kind of be a disappointment in many ways, kind of exploring Christianity. I mean, at the moment, I'm sort of kind of have doubts, but I've just been, you know, exploring other things, not just politics, like sort of philosophy. And I wanted to come back because I really miss having a Substack. And
do you have a backup archive of your old articles?
I deleted them.
Oh, that sucks.
I mean, they don't really represent me anymore. But I just wanted to have an outlet to write. And it might be like movie reviews. I am unfortunately quite restricted in what I can put out there because of, you know, the doxing situation. But I feel like, you know, a platform where, and of course my platform's much reduced compared to what it used to be. I talk about all this in my article why I deleted Anglo-Futurist, but I like writing. I enjoy writing. I enjoy discussing ideas. you know, aesthetics, movie reviews. I mean, I think since coming back, it's not just been politics I've wanted to write about. It's been like other topics as well, which
like more culture and philosophy.
Yeah, well, yeah, culture and philosophy. Yeah, yeah. And when I do talk about politics, it's sort of more like very abstract political theory, like my own like kind of ideals. And it's not really, you know, about kind of what was the movement for, I think we can now say the movement formerly known as the dissident right, that's very much behind me now. I don't think I'd really say I'm kind of left or right. I'd say my views are always evolving, always developing.
But I guess the thing is with like the left versus right spectrum, it's more like if you can't, you're not a right winger, but if the left is attacking you and trying to cancel you, it kind of forces you to be right wing, even if you find right a lot of the right wing objectionable.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I have no doubts that I would still be considered a right winger. Like, no doubts about that. But I think there is also the opposite concern that sometimes you can feel so sort of humiliated by that experience that you
it radicalizes you.
Yeah, it does. And I have talked about this, that many of my views were sort of performatively extreme because I wanted to prove that the quote unquote right side of history did not dictate my beliefs.
Like, I feel like I've noticed this, like, with my political trajectory, is it goes back pretty far, because
you're a veteran, Robert Starr.
So I would say, like, during the Bush era, maybe more kind of like the Ron Paul kind of libertarian scene. Yeah. And then during the Obama era, it was more alt-right. And then during Trump's first term, I kind of moved away from the right. And I discovered different things, like briefly the Andrew Yang thing, the Colexit scene, and the kind of YIMBY movement. And then I moved away from that kind of stuff, but it was more safer and kind of left-coded.
Yeah.
And then also, even though Colexit, they had their own kind of like scandal involving Russiagate. But then also during for Trump's first term, I got more into cultural stuff. And on my Star Truth Radio podcast, I was interviewing musicians and artists and movie directors and moving away from politics. And then what happened is then I was maybe about COVID, like not a hardcore like red tribe and COVID. My view on that was a little more nuanced and balanced, but on some of the stuff like the George Floyd stuff, Black Lives Matter, the cancel culture, that made me feel a bit more right wing.
Yeah,
a bit around 2020 and 2021. And then now with like Trump's second term, like when Biden was in power, it was like the whole like the right wing versus the woke versus the right wing fighting.
Yeah.
And now like when Trump's second term, it feels like you can just sort of take a breather.
I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, the Biden era was awful. It was just so extreme on cultural issues. But I don't want to sort of get involved in that. It's funny you talking about all this stuff, because to me, like, I was a kid at the stuff you're talking about. And like, even Trump's first term, like, I was an immature, edgy teenager. But it's like you're ancient, Robert. It's like you see things from like, you know, the early 2010s, and like on an internet level, like to me that's ancient history, which is quite funny.
I guess the thing about the labeling is like, should we reject the right wing and say we're radical centrist, or label for like neoliberals like Noah Smith, or just maybe stop talking about the labels?
I'm gonna stop talking about the labels. The thing is, my views now might be, you know, my views 6 months time might be different to my views now, because I'm always sort of reading and exploring different ideas, and I don't want to close myself off from any tribe. I feel like the, you know, dissident right became a bit tribal and when anybody would sort of show an independent streak, Dave Green would be there to denounce them.
And it's a bit more like, I think it's difficult for people who are like high in openness and right leaning because you sort of have like the Chud types take over. But I did notice what is kind of weird about like the original alt-right scene, it kind of, in a strange way, it kind of like, as far as I cast, it mirrored the left in the sense of being like a weird, like you had people like Greg Johnson and Richard Spencer who were like Brahmin, but then you had
still,
a more kind of like
I
a Dalit kind of
Trump's,
a,
I still read
kind
Trump's
of a neat
current.
Like Dalit side, like a Brahmin Dalit alliance, which ironically mirrors the left because the, like the normie conservative movement, it's like sort of the merchant types, the Vaishyas, you have the warriors, like military law enforcement, and you have the kind of normie working class like the Shudra, to use the Hindu caste analogy. But the normie conservatives, they hate the Brahmins, like the intellectuals, but they also kind of shit on the Dalits, like the unemployed people. So I think the alt-right and the mainstream conservative movement, like they're both right-wing in a superficial sense of opposing leftism and egalitarianism, but I think they were on a fundamental, like, philosophical and caste level, they were diametrically opposed.
Okay, all right. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I grew up, so because I was born 2001, I've recently turned 25. And so I remember the alt-right. I mean, I was sort of on like anti-SJW YouTube. I don't think I ever went into sort of alt-right stuff. But anyway, I mean, we can talk about this all day. Every one of sort of Walt Bismarck's podcasts is sort of talking about this sort of stuff. Like, oh, we're so high in openness, you know, not like those chuds.
But you kind of had a bit of a falling out with him, and like, I'm on good terms with Walt, so like, I'm not going to censor you for dissing him, but
no, it's
like,
fine. No, it's fine.
But I think Walt's like, I think he's cool. I think he gets it. I don't think he's going to be like, oh, you're talking shit about us. I think we can talk about this. And like, if Walt wants to do some kind of debate or talk about that, that's
fine. It's fine. I mean,
I guess it's more about his focus on status hierarchies. And I think Walt is absolutely correct. Well, he talks
all
a lot
this
about
stuff about status hierarchy.
How status is a mere. Status is sort of a mass, morality is a mass for status, which is absolutely correct.
It's so cringe. It's just so, like, dry and crass.
But it's nihilistic, you would say.
It's just crass. I mean, can we not do this whole thing just me shitting on Walt Bismarck? Because I'm already doing that enough on notes. I want to talk about your book, which was absolutely hilarious. And
well, I mean, the book does deal with, I think it deals with themes of status.
Well, it's just so funny. It's like when
I
was
feel
part, when I was
bad
part of
because
the quote
it got
kid,
so.
Can I
the
speak
book, my it? Book, Journey to Vapor Island, it was released way back in 20. I think it was 2017. It's almost a decade ago. It got like so little traction.
Anyway,
even though it got some great, it got some excellent reviews. James O'Meara on Countercurrents reviewed it. This guy, Ben Arzate and Culture Vultures, a few other people, some excellent reviews. Like,
can I have,
the book got like so little traction. I had a sequel, the sequel to the book, Vaporfornia, that was released in like 2022.
Oh, there's a sequel? Gosh.
Yeah.
Gosh. I know. But anyway, I'll just tell you what
I actually do want to re-release both the books at some point, but who knows when.
Yeah, can I get a word in, Robert?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, but it's just like, I'm trying to say things, and I know you've got lots to say, it's your podcast, obviously, but I just want to say, I really liked your book, and I think when I was like part of the quote-unquote dissident right, I kind of had to pretend to be sort of outraged.
Oh, so you were doing this moral signaling about the fetishes. Like, it just felt so over the top performative. And I felt like I actually sort of relate to that because
it was sort of a joke. I mean, it was just so
entertaining.
It was
sort of a joke.
It was so entertaining, just the beef, you know, the banter. And
I mean, I wasn't offended because it brought publicity, but.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Also performative.
Yeah, you're good with that. And I just, this is what I love about the book. It's so authentically Robert Stark. And you don't kind of like, it's so like individually you. You don't really care about, you know, I mean, the first half, you know, it follows. It's sort of Taxi Driver meets Clueless meets sort of like alt-right terminology. And then like by the second half, there isn't really a story anymore. It's just sort of like you're kind of. And what I love about it is that it's like it's offensive on every possible level. It's
well,
like
the question is, does it offend everyone?
Well,
or
yes.
Does, or does
yeah,
it cancel?
Because
does it being offensive
woke,
to everyone, does it,
offends, it
cancel it out?
It
what
offends,
obviously it offends like politically correct people
and trad
but
people
it offends
because there's
trads as well.
frequent golden showers. You know, it just reminds me of Bonnie Blue saying, you know, I'm going to be turning my baby shower into a golden shower. And, you know, and so it's not really, I guess, just not even that taboo anymore. You know, there's a nice scene with, you know, somebody taking a piss shower. These people have been bred specifically for the purposes of being, peeing on people. I have to say, I found the.
Like, it's kind of
I
like
found
eugenics.
When these kind of like.
Like a eugenic cast thing mixed with like perversions and like to ever offend everyone.
Did you base Wendy on Xenia on a top from GoldenEye?
No, but I do feel like the name Wendy, it's such. Like, it's such a like Gen X kind of 80s movie name.
I loved Wendy.
But it works.
Yeah.
It works for like the 80s nostalgia
like,
kind of thing, but it's not, it wouldn't be, it's not a Zoomer name.
I found like the whole thing, the stuff with Wendy was by far like the hottest part of the book. And one thing that I didn't like, it's like Gnomes, he's just obsessed with like the virgin Natalie, but it's like, come on, that's a bit boring. Like that's a bit sort of trad coded. I would have, I think, you know, I think the kind of the stuff with Wendy, peculiar experiments, I thought that was the best bit, and I think that should have been more more prevalent in the book.
Oh, so you think I didn't go far enough with degeneracy?
I kind of feel like a great thing was like when he realized that, like, if feminism was this, you know, he'd actually like, he wants to sort of, you know, to abolish the patriarchy and kill the chads so that he can live a life of being a, you know, like, an oral servant. And I just think, like, you know, like, why not? Like, why not? Like, you know, if, I think that would be cool. I mean, that would be a way that you could, that feminists could actually persuade me.
But you, I think you may have, you said this, that you said that, or feminism or women, it's not, it's at their power bottoms.
Yeah, I like pure power tops like Wendy in the book. That was so hot.
Yeah, do you think it relates to some of the stuff I've been posting about on Substack notes and even in the articles?
Oh, you're off. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the thing. It, like, the book is so authentically you. It's just like, it's almost like so bad it's good. But it's almost like so bad it's good is almost like a genre of comedy. It's funny because it has that sort of so bad it's good kind of vibe. And it just like goes just like from one thing to another. It's just sort of like, you know, from one thing to the next thing, and it's just like, you know, how can Robert Stark squeeze in, you know, as many of these fetish scenes as possible? like it starts out as a story, and then like by the second
well,
half,
it breaks down, you don't really care about the story. Like as a more conventional coming of age script, but then it breaks down into something like more surreal, like almost like William Burroughs, like. Or like William Burroughs' Naked Lunch in the second half.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there's loads of, yeah, like, yeah, it is surrealist, but that was good. Like it was just, it was funny. It was really entertaining.
Well, I mean, it's writing is a form of mysticism because the author imposes consciousness upon the readers, and they just have to kind of take that.
So anyway, we were gonna stick to a script of questions, which we seem
we went out of order. Let's see, where should we? We could revisit the UK election. That's kind of like going
way
up.
Boring. I don't want to talk about that.
Okay. I guess the thing is, like, if someone's from a country, you always kind of you ask them.
Yeah. Okay.
But I guess it's like it's so boring. You think it's pretty boring and cliche.
Yeah, I know. Stuff. Well, actually, like, you know, I'm kind of on academic agent side. I actually think a lot of the kind of anti-Keir Starmer stuff was slop. And he actually, like, he got the numbers of immigration, like, immigration numbers down.
Because the irony is that immigration was actually high, much, much, much higher under the Tories than
Keir
Starmer.
Well, because I think the problem with all conservative parties, and I think this is what you see with Trump, is because so their base are their donors that are rich businessmen that need.
Yeah, that's what I said about caste. It's sort of peasant.
And,
it's like a weird peasant merchant alliance.
Okay, but just let me finish. And then the other part of their coalition is boomers, right? That wants to pay as few taxes as possible. Aren't concerned with rising house prices and low wages because
Trump said
like
Trump said he wants, he blatantly actually said that he wants housing prices to go up.
Well, this is the thing. So anyway, just to go briefly go on to British politics. So a lot of and this is why I'm kind of, you know, very disillusioned with politics, because right wing parties, because their base is big donors and boomers, and both of those constituencies are insulated from the negative effects of mass immigration and stand to benefit from it. Even though these parties technically, you know, promise to, you know, bring numbers down, when it actually comes to the hard decision making, you know, is it, you know, employing cheap labour or cutting benefits for pensioners, what ultimately is going to be the thing which, you know, keeps the boomers turning up to the polls? It's in this country
because immigration
pension, but so what
immigration
I'm,
props
I'm saying
up
is,
real estate in the stock market.
Well, what I'm saying is actually, like, I mean there's lots of things I don't like about Keir Starmer. He's gone now, he's going to be replaced with Andy Burnham. I'm willing to give him a chance. He has some interesting ideas. He doesn't seem, you know, too woke. I feel like that, you know, if it's going to be done, you're going to do the Danish Social Democrats route, because, or the Mark Carney route, because those left wing parties, like, they do have like an alternative
base of support. They have the trade unions. Yeah.
So, and because they have the trade unions, it means that they aren't just dependent on these big donors, that they are actually a counter elite. And so even though, you know, they are kind of, you know, infected by sort of wokeism a lot, I feel like when you look at the actual numbers, the sort of the center left is actually, you know, doing the most in terms of, you know, bite and not just bark. So I guess that's why I don't really want to talk about UK politics, because it's all just theatre. Academic Agent's a little bit more pro Restore Britain than I am. I just think Restore Britain's just more of the same, you know.
They seem to fail. Their election polling was utter failure.
Yeah. So it's just Reform, but Rupert Lowe instead of Nigel Farage, and you have loads of, like,
and Farage, I think, is having some scandal where he's resigning.
Yeah, I just don't care, Robert. I just really don't care.
So what you were saying is how, like, Denmark's an example. They have a center-left social democracy government, and they've actually really cracked down on mass migration.
And Keir Starmer and Shabima Mahmood's reformed. I mean, the Tories, when they were an outgoing government, they did put in some last minute changes, which was behind some of the reduction. But a lot of it has been Labour. So this is why I just don't care.
How bad is the crackdown on free speech? Do you think, like, right wing, is it really bad, or do you think, like, right wing kind of slop exaggerates it?
Americans love to stir the pot in this country. There's all this slop about civil war that, like, a few media commentators that are sort of plugged into the US ecosystem are sort of sort of spilling this. And it's sort of ultimately, and this is again, how I'm kind of on the same page as Academic Agent. It really has the goal of getting people to support Israel. All this counter-jihad, civil war stuff, it is just for that purpose. I mean, you saw it in America, I mean, Trump, the kind of the online base thought that they were, running the show, but really it was three groups, the ultra-rich finances and big tech, that's one group. You've got the fossil fuel companies, which is why they always deny climate change. And then the last constituency is, of course, Zionism. And it's the same here. It's all just about whipping people up and clickbait. It's just fake.
Do you have thoughts on the overall decline of the UK? I mean, obviously there's this like kind of right wing slop hyperbole about like civil war and collapse, but is it sort of more like just like a gradual decline?
I mean, it's been declining for so long that I don't know. I mean, everybody is depressed about politics in this country. My parents are quite left wing. They're very left wing, and they are just as disillusioned with politics as I am.
Well, I think it's,
No,
yeah.
nobody feels good about the way this country is heading. There's no feeling of sort of like optimism. I feel like here's something which is quite interesting. I feel like the mood of the 2020s is kind of similar to the 1970s. It
Well, the
feels.
1970s was it was a bad economy, but there was still a sense of exuberance from like the culture and having a more youthful population.
I mean, what I kind of feel like is like the 60s was like an explosion, all this cultural change. And then like the 70s, in Britain and America, it was like, okay, well, where are things going to go? Because there was a feeling that it wasn't quite certain that the changes of the 60s weren't going to be rolled back. In ultimately they weren't, but I feel like the 2020, because the 2010s was I guess the sort of the woke decade. The
It seemed
2020s
so.
is like a very kind of nihilist, it's sort of like a kind of in between sort
Yeah,
of
it seems
time.
the vibe shift, it's not like there's not like the energy from like the woke versus MAGA. And looking back, like a lot of us got caught up in these culture wars, but it feels so performative. And like even then, like wokeness, it used to mean like being anti-woke meant you opposed like anti-white or anti-male discrimination. It's become this weird kind of GOP wedge culture war
Well,
issue
yeah, this thing is
that you
just
hear in
it's
Fox News.
well,
And
yeah.
it's just more just kind of like very stagnant, depressing, nihilistic energy now. And neither side, I think both left wing people and right wing
Oh,
people, like
wait.
they both feel
Okay.
totally burnt out.
I think that's true. I mean, you're seeing it in sort of like culture a little bit. So have you seen Backrooms or Obsession?
No, but I want to see Backrooms.
Well, both of them are very good. I did reviews on them. And what's good about them is they're very, like, non-political. It doesn't, like, honestly, like, both films, you can get something out of it, whatever side of the kind of spectrum you're on. And I think, and there is a bit of a sort of 70s vibe in a lot of those sort of, because of course they're quite, they were indie films. And of course, every era has its sort of uniqueness and
So like Backrooms, it's sort of, it could be like that, like what I wrote that article about dream mole world. It's sort of like the dream.
Well, those dreams you have that are very claustrophobic.
You
love back rooms after you wrote that, and I remember.
Did you read my mole world article?
Yeah, and I just read the comment saying, don't drink iced tea before bed.
So, like, some people, they literally believe that Mole World, like, they believe it's an actual, like, metaphysical realm, like the astral plane that you visit in your dreams.
A bit like Chris Chan.
Have you had those dreams where your dreams are, like, being stuck in these, like, really, these endless, like, moles or creepy labyrinths?
I'm not sure if, like, exactly like that, but.
I want you to talk more about your review, because I haven't got a chance to see it yet, but it's interesting. Like it really, how the themes about the subconscious, the kind of like labyrinth and what it's a metaphor for philosophically and the genre of horror. Because if you wanted to talk more about your review, you can
read my article. It's there. I don't know how much like spoilers you want. That's the question. If you haven't seen it yet, but it's a good film.
Well, I mean, spoilers are fine.
Okay. It's a good film. It kind of very much has that sort of ambient feeling of the kind of the liminal subconscious. And it also kind of...
The liminal, like, it's the subconscious, but also, like, the liminal architecture.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Like, so kind of places, like, I was in Vegas a few months ago. You go to Vegas, I don't know, you've probably not been to Vegas.
No,
not been there, but you go to these, like, casinos, and they're designed to get, for you to kind of get, like, lost and gamble. But I think when you walk around late at night, I wasn't drinking, but, like, I was kind of sober, other than taking some medication. But I was on weed a previous trip, and you're walking around at night, and sometimes you're tired in a hypnagogic state. And it creates that vibe, or sometimes you go to certain like hotels or conference centers, and you're just walking around, and it.
Robert Stark was a unique individual, sober. Just wait till you experience Robert Stark on drugs.
Well, I don't really do drugs. Like I have written about psychedelic mushrooms, but I don't view it as drugs. I view it more as a spiritual thing. Psilocybin. Okay. No, but it's like, I mean, you can have these experiences totally sober. It's not
really
about
drugs. Have you seen the show Skins?
Maybe one episode.
Oh, well, there's an episode where in the forest they take magic mushrooms. It's a good episode. Anyway, that was the article when one comment said, don't drink iced tea before bed.
Well, I've been having these dreams, like, kind of, like, mole world dreams since, like, a small child. Like, they're, some of them are very interesting and some very disturbing.
Yeah, I think you're gonna need to watch Backrooms because,
I plan on watching it.
Yeah, okay, cool. You should watch Obsession as well. It's kind of like a double feature, almost, the kind of, you know, indie horror movies.
Because it was like Backrooms, it was like a 4chan meme.
Yeah,
Someone found this obscure photo on 4chan, and then, like, you're stuck over and over again, and you can't escape.
Yeah, I mean, I knew about Backrooms first because of TikTok, but then after I'd seen Backrooms, it was kind of like a double feature with Obsession. You know, a bit like the kind of Barbieheimer thing. So you kind of see both, you know. So you should see that one as well.
Do you want to kind of explain where your current ideology, philosophy...
My current ideology...
And theology is.
Oh.
And how they intersect.
Well, what do you want? So I would describe I'm like nominally a Christian, right? Because I go to church, I sort of have that kind of community.
Is it like Anglican
it's
an or Episcopalian?
It's an Anglican church. It's like a moderately conservative Anglican church. But in terms of my theology/philosophy, I am a monist critical rationalist. Which is essentially, I take the the kind of outlines of the pre-Socratic ancient Greek philosopher Xenophanes and combine it with insights from Spinoza and David Hume and Karl Popper and Imre Lakatos. So it's basically, it's metaphysically realist, but morally anti-realist in that it believes it, you know, that morality is downstream from, you know, sort of cooperation between humans.
Yeah, I view kind of like, I mean, I have criticisms of like the Abrahamic moral authoritarianism, but I'm not a moral, like, nihilist either. Like my philosophy is more like in the line of the Neoplatonism emanation, where you have like emanations come from the divine source.
Yeah.
So you have like some things that are higher up and emanations that are absolute, and then you have more things that are more conditional.
Yeah, I like
tribal things. Or even with like you put
I like Plotinian Neoplatonism, but then, you know, the later ones did something quite incredible. They made Christianity seem like the more rational, less superstitious.
What about Origen, the theologian
Yeah, Origen's cool, but I'm talking about like the non-Christian ones, so like Porphyry, Proclus, Imbletius.
Yeah, Porphyry was I think Porphyry was pretty anti-Christian.
Yeah, but that's not my main problem. The problem with, Iamblichus and Proclus is that they multiply the hypostases in a very sort of speculative, quite arbitrary way. Whereas I think Plotinus is actually better than Plato. I prefer Plotinus than Plato.
That's why, like, the term, you know, I call my new religion Cosmoplatonism, but I wish Neoplatonism had a better name because...
Call it Plotinism. Plotinus is like that kind of...
Neoplatinus?
Forgotten about philosopher. Yeah. Because he's always called a Neoplatonist, but it's like he's his own thing. I mean, it's like calling him Aristotle a Neoplatonist because he had some similarities with Plato. So, I like Plotinus a fair bit, but I don't like the later pagan Neoplatonism. I'm quite partial to like Christian Neoplatonism, but that's because I'm like kind of in Christian mode.
But I guess, like, with my religion, Cosmoplatonism, well, Origen, he came up with the Trinity, and that was influenced by Neoplatonism, but there is kind of, like, a Trinity with my religion, Cosmoplatonism. Like, there's the divine source
the
and a divine consciousness.
The Anima Mundi, right?
Yeah, that's what they describe it as. But the avatars,
funny.
So I see, like, the Christian analogy is, I think, Christ and Christianity
Christ
is representing...
Is
an avatar, well, representing a divine avatar of things like love, compassion, and bringing people to the divine, like they're carrying their souls across for the afterlife. That's what I see the representation of. But then there are these other avatars, like I think Eros is like the warrior, and or like Cupid is like romantic. Gaia is like nature. And all different, like different ones. I forget every single one from my article.
I mean, it's quite funny that Catholicism kind of leans towards sort of henotheism, which means it's like kind of one ultimate god, but there's like lots of different other gods. But anyway, what I was saying was that, So I guess, I mean, I know that they kind of are in conflict, because of course, if you were Christian, you kind of have to be a moral realist. But I do, I wrote an article about reconciling it. And I guess I am sort of more of a cultural Christian than a sort of full on Christian, and that my real sort of philosophical / theological viewpoint is, monist critical rationalism, or Neo-Xenophanesism is sort of what I am.
So I guess like my criticism of Christianity or Abrahamism, like a fundamental difference is I plan on writing about this, the kind of like theosophy HBD is I see like
they
core...
don't let you go down on an 18-year-old Jewess.
Well, I mean, I should get to that later, but that's not what
I'm
saying.
And they don't let an 18-year-old Jewess be eaten out by a working class goy schmuck.
So, I see, like, Christian theology, Abrahamism, they believe that God created everyone in their perfect form, but that through free will of rejecting God or even, like, rejecting Jesus Christ's gift of salvation, some people are, they're damned to hell. And, like, my theology is basically that emanation comes from the divine, and then that creates evolution. So there is dysgenics or eugenics. That comes through evolution, through the emanation principle. So I don't believe everyone is created perfectly.
How many hypostases do you believe in? Are you like a minimalist Neoplatonist like Plotinus, or are you wacky shit like Proclus and Ian Bleachus?
But what I was going to say is that I do, like, that view also means that, like, it's more forgiving of that. It's also, like, more morally forgiving, because, like, I do believe in universal salvation through the emanation principle.
Like, as a Christian, I don't believe in hell.
And everything emanates from the divine and everything returns. So it's like there's a purification. Like, there is a purification principle. And, like, it doesn't mean, like, when I say dysgenics, I don't mean things even like IQ or how people look, but even things like how people are genetically wired to be spiritual. Like, some people are genetically wired to be more spiritual, and there is a gene for that. But there is sort of like, I think generally near-death experience accounts, they align more with universal salvation, though, like, there are other, some of them with more Christian themes. And, like, my theory about the more hellish NDEs is, like, I think the souls are getting trapped. They're not damned, but they're getting trapped, like, in the astral plane. That's my theological theory, but I'm not totally certain about that. But I generally, my theology, that's like my core theology.
Okay. Yeah. Well, again, it's like I I don't know. I mean, I really I don't know. I mean, as a Christian, I'm a universalist. Like, I don't believe in hell. Like, even as a Christian, but, like, you know, I actually sort of think I'm a more as I said, like I'm not like a dog, like I'm not really a kind of sort of like real Christian. Basically, I'm kind of a cultural Christian. I sort of understand that now. I'm not going to try and deny it.
But I think with these different kind of spiritual paths that relate to politics and culture, there are these different routes. So one of them, I think it can be trad, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
But is that you kind of create your own like, well, there's
I converted to Christianity because of the culture war. Like that was why I started going to church and stuff, because it was like kind of the only sort of shelter from wokeism. But actually sort of like, you know, taking it seriously and reading about the history, like, I don't think I want to return to burning people at the stake for heresy, you know. So I'm kind of like, I went into it sort of for like political reasons, and now I've sort of come out of it, and I'm sort of inquiring. I don't really know.
But I think the different paths, like, there's sort of asceticism is like,
I'm not an ascetic. I'm very much
that,
not
that's
an ascetic.
Like turning away from society and turning inwards, and
no, I mean, that's asceticism is more like, you know, foregoing worldly things, sort of like, you know, living with like as little as possible.
Then there's more like creating more parallel societies, building your own kind of tribe.
Yeah,
which is like, it could be trad, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah,
creating a parallel society. And then there's the one like using theurgy to expand consciousness.
Yeah,
to
me, theurgy is when you lose me, right? Because theurgy is just like occult magic.
Well, I think like changing aesthetics, like using aesthetics, music, sexuality, and more controversial.
You gotta make it Robert Stark.
So there's aesthetics, like the architecture, built environment, or like natural geography. There's sexuality, and
yeah.
then there's things like even more controversial, like what traits you select for breeding, and these all like select, they all like shift consciousness because consciousness with spiritual and psychological reacting to your surrounding environments. When you change the surrounding environments, you shift, you radically expand consciousness because. That's like, are you familiar? Because I don't know if you're familiar with the author Colin Wilson. He really, his whole like writings are really about consciousness and how
yeah,
like
I
our
mean,
lives,
I mean, in terms of consciousness,
our lives feel
I'll
like
tell you
so
what my
small
views
and
are.
unimportant because our consciousness is dimmed. And like the more you expand consciousness, like the longer your life, you extend your life, you make time feel much. More extended.
I'll tell you what my
like
views on
consciousness
are. If you
do like the mundane, same thing every day, you shorten your lifespan.
Non-dualist.
But.
In terms of consciousness, I'm a non-dualist and a cosmo-psychist. I feel like that's the most parsimonious explanation. I don't know, because I mean, Platonian Neoplatonism has the anima mundi, doesn't it?
Right.
So the idea that, you know, we're all one soul and just sort of droplets in that bigger soul, which is possible. But I think even Plotinus is sort of, you know, by categorizing me, the one, the nous, the anima mundi. It's aesthetically cool. I mean, there are lots of philosophies that I kind of like the aesthetics of that I don't subscribe to, like Pythagoreanism. Like Neoplatonism, like the later Neoplatonists, the more sort of maximalist Neoplatonists, were kind of they were kind of a mixture between Plotinus and Pythagoreanism, which was quite interesting. But anyway, so that's, I guess, is my sort of theological slash philosophical views. And anybody who is listening to this can. You know, check out my work to sort of see how I explore it and give arguments for why I believe it.
Do you want to kind of explain your current? I think you explained your theology pretty good. Do you want to explain your current political philosophy?
My current political philosophy. Okay, yeah. So I actually think it's sort of like what I was advocating, like at the core during Anglo-Futurists, but because there was so much sort of other ideas swimming around.
I think what you were saying earlier is that you had these core philosophical ideas, but because you had the emotional reaction to being attacked by the left. You felt maybe it was tainted in
I was performatively extreme because I didn't want to give any sort of moral weight to the quote-unquote right side of history. And it kind of made me feel sort of empowered a bit by just sort of defacing every single one of their sort of sacred cows. It was quite satisfying. But as for me now, so I believe in sovereign polyarchic pan-Westernism. So I basically believe in democracy, in popular sovereignty, but I don't dismiss elite theory completely. And so I think democracy, you know, as a real system, right, as like a non-rhetorical device, is something closer to polyarchy, which is a system where there is a sort of pluralism between different elite groups, and the people can sort of, you know, choose one elite which sort of looks after their interests. It's sovereign because I think that you can only have popular sovereignty if you are if you possess the five sovereignties, which are political, military, economic, technological, and cultural, and if you don't have that, then you aren't truly sovereign, and therefore you aren't truly populous, you know, truly sort of polyarchic slash democratic. because you're going to be sort of influenced by sort of propaganda from great powers and stuff like that. And the reason why I'm a pan-Westernist, which is that I believe that the, you know, Europe and North America and the Anglosphere should unite into a federation, is because I think the problem with like pan-Anglosphereism is that America is sort of, particularly with like the Ellis Islanders, is like, it's just as much like continental European as Anglosphere. And also I feel like, you know, the larger a federation is, like the more comfortable it's going to be to have autarky. So if you look at like North Korea, they're like always starving because they, you know, they're so small, they don't have very much fertile land.
So Juche
is going to be a kind of, is uncomfortable for them. But if you have a vast, I mean, America, like America alone probably could do it, but I'm British and I, you know, I don't think Britain could. I think Britain would really struggle.
Right.
So that's why I, you know, I believe in a pan-Western federation to sort of make the achievement of the other two things, you know, democracy / polyarchy, and sovereignty in that. Can be achieved with maximum comfort. That's basically it.
So they're presented as like the two options, either like the Westphalian nation state that emerged like after World War One or earlier in the 19th century versus globalism. Those are presented as like the only two options. And they're obviously both flawed. Like nationalists will say either we have a nation state or we become like the European Union. And those are presented as the only options. But it's kind of, it makes me think of like more like the Holy Roman Empire, where it's like an empire, but it's where you have city states that have that work together, but they're mostly autonomous.
Yeah, it's a little bit like that. I mean, I'm more thinking, because, you know, India, right, is a civilization state, right? It's not a nation state. And they were able to, I mean, it was a bad policy decision because of where they were at in their development, but they were able to kind of achieve autarky or something close to autarky in the post-period.
Like you have these different, like there's different strains of Hindu nationalism. Like one of them
wants to
create a nation state, while another strain of Hindu nationalism.
So what I'm saying is
India as more like ethno-pluralism kind of.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is that I feel like, you know, the thing is, it's already de facto the case. I mean, the West today, right, is kind of like the Holy Roman Empire. Like, that's the state of affairs we have today. We have loads of overlapping treaties. We have NATO, we have the European Union, we have, you know, European Free Trade Agreement, the Council of Europe, all of these sort of overlapping things. So the West is already kind of like the Holy Roman Empire. Of course, it's not, you know, completely free movement, free trade towards every part of it, but neither was the Holy Roman Empire. So I just think that, like, it's better for us to sort of formalize the arrangement of sort of the global American Empire and sort of narrow it so that it's not world policemen. We just sort of are, you know, the American Empire, which is now, you know, the Western Civilizational Union, you know, gives everyone a seat at the table, and makes de jure and more democratic what's already the de facto situation because of like trade links and military security and all that.
And then, because it's like also like people feel like when it comes to sovereignty, like this is an issue in America and probably in other countries where it's like you either have to choose between bureaucracy and government or corporations and the quote unquote private sector. But they're both, that duopoly is very bad at offering sovereignty. As you mentioned, these different components like the culture, the economic sphere, governments. It's just a really bad, it's a bad system and it's a bad dichotomy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a flawed dichotomy.
So in terms of my political views, that's basically it. I also am very hostile to natural rights, the whole pre-political, pre-social rights. I think that that is really the bedrock of what I really cannot stand, and I hated it in wokeism, but it's not just wokeism. And actually, if you look at, you know, institutions like the Claremont Institute, they are like almost like the complete opposite of what I believe in, sort of centering sort of natural rights against popular sovereignty. And my issue with it is it's just fundamentally sort of authoritarian. It's, you know, judges declaring themselves philosopher kings and sort of finding rights, which really, I mean, it's not too different in practice to like the Iranian Guardian Council. I mean, the Warren Court and the Guardian Council of Iran are, in my view, pretty similar, because they both believe that there is a sort of, you know, that kind of, that there is morality above politics and rights above politics, and that they, the chosen, the, you know, the kind of the philosopher kings, can make decisions better than the people can. And I really cannot stand that. So I am a...
So you would replace that with just leaving morality issues all to a local level?
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of sort of territorial covenant of citizens, like, you know, morality is downstream from law. Not quite that, but I think that, you know, really, we all have different moral opinions, right? And cooperating, you know, as a society is about building a sort of shared framework that we can all agree on, or at least sort of the most of the largest number of us can at least sort of agree to peacefully coexist. I mean, it's quite hard for me to sort of explain everything on a podcast, because I have sort of laid this out in detail in my articles. But as for what my current political ideology is, I mean, you know, I'm still anti-woke, but I think I've sort of narrowed down what it was that I absolutely could not stand about wokeism, and it actually overlaps with a lot of sort of conservatives in America. It's this my rights are not up for debate kind of posture, and I just hate it. And so
you're talking about the kind of the gender war stuff where
not so much in my articles,
more in your notes. So it's like, I think the whole issue with like the feminist side is that how women are sort of like power bottoms and feminism is dishonest, but then the manosphere stuff, it's just very, very kind of crude, like macho signaling, and it doesn't really offer anything. Well, the thing is that they're kind of two heads of the same coin, because I think with the whole feminist side is that it's all about the women being sort of like the power bottoms. But with then it's like with the whole sort of manosphere stuff, which I'd say, I guess it's different. I think like maybe it exists in a different form than it did in the past, but it permeates that mentality, permeates the right. So they're sort of against sort of like any kind of like male sensitivity. And it's just about this sort of crude sort of like status signaling.
Yeah. And it, I mean, these days I just think Walt Bismarck is a pimp, and his notes, come across like the handwritten notes of a serial killer. So, yeah,
I'm friends with Walt, so it's like I don't want to get between your back and forth fight, but I'm not gonna censor you. I'm not gonna cut it out. I like Walt. I consider him a friend, but I'm not gonna like but at the same time, like you're free to talk shit. I'm not gonna censor you either.
We're good friends, but it's just, I mean, he blocked me.
Oh right, he did.
First. When I had alt accounts, this was shortly after I deleted Anglo Futurists. I didn't know why, because maybe I just wasn't useful to him anymore. He's just like an Andrew Tate style grifter. And he's blocked me again now. So I'm just more focused on my writing, my exploring political, philosophical ideas. I am partial to a bit of notes drama. Let's not pretend I'm not. But, yeah.
But I think he promote like he does. It is true that Walt is open about this. Like he promotes like men as world tops, and I think he promotes the whole thing. He had an article promoting your Amadio.
Well, he hates female pleasure. He says, you know, I think, you know, anyone who performs cunnilingus is gay, or like, you know, and it just, I don't know, it's just something really quite. Yeah, just sort of makes my skin crawl about some of the things he writes.
So it's like you can sort of frame the whole gender war dynamics based on the whole politics of oral. So the whole issue is like the manosphere, they think only men should be oral tops, but the ironic part is then the feminists, they're power bottoms because they're like, they use being an oral bottom to chat as a way to achieve status. So they're a kind of... We're kind of the same on that, using the metric of the politics.
Well, yeah,
well.
Yeah, you're a little bit more open and sort of see. I don't know. I've sort of definitely moved more in the Robert Stark direction, right? You know, since Angblade Beaches, my sort of nihilism has kind of eroded away my social conservatism.
So who do you think should be like the top and bottom? Do you think it should be more like?
I gave my just in notes now my 100% unbiased, value-free, analytical, not ulterior motivated whatsoever.
Like, do you think it would be like, or should it be like a like an older upper class woman doming like a young younger guy, or should it be like a college? Like Zuma heiress, like doming, like a working class middle aged guy.
Well, that's your thing. Nobody can forget that that's your thing. You know, I mean, it's quite. I love your book because I mean, you know, we've just sort of accepted Robert Stark as a Substack treasure.
Do you think those acts can be channeled into either mysticism or like a new radical political ideology?
If you want to engage in severe post hoc rationalization, sure.
Do you want to ask me about like my experiences in living in England briefly in 2002?
All right then. I mean, 2000. I was one then.
What parts have you lived in, unless you don't want to dox yourself?
So I was born in the north of England. My parents are from there. But I've lived in the south, I'll just say the southeast, outside London, but the southeast, since I was four. And I grew up here. I mean, I'm familiar with London. I lived there for a bit when I was doing my master's. I was doing my master's at it overlapped with the time I was doing Anglo Futurist. I can kind of use the northern cards, but I'm you know, from the southeast, really. Yeah, we were talking about.
So, what part of London did you live in?
I don't want to.
That's fine. But I remember, so I was only there, so okay, so. I flew into London. We were there for, my family was like 3 days. It was pretty briefly, but we stayed in an area called Vauxhall. I don't know if you have heard of it.
I have family there, yeah.
So what I remember is I heard they've done, like, since 2002, they've done this massive redevelopment with, skyscrapers.
Yes, because of the Olympics. I think in that area, it was the 2012 Olympics, yeah.
But I remember it being kind of, I wouldn't say it wasn't a terrible area, but it was kind of an area that was like a bit working class, had some like rougher, seedy pockets, but it was very close to like the desirable parts of West London.
Yeah.
And it seemed pretty, what I do remember, it did seem diverse because like American cities are a bit more like racially segregated. Like I do remember it was kind of like working class whites and like some people who may have been like Jamaican.
Yeah.
And then there were some like a lot of, there were also a lot of homeless people walking around at night. Like at night, there were pockets that felt a little bit sketchy. And then let's see, but it was close. It was close. Like I do remember like all the touristy stuff, Piccadilly Circus, like going by Buckingham Palace, like Big Ben was small. I was underwhelmed by the size, like phallically speaking, but it was really magical. Like it was really magical when it was lit up at night. Like I think I forget, trying to think of the names, like maybe it was Green Park, and it was kind of the pretty magical but touristy. Then I went to, let's see, I went to Notting Hill.
Oh, you know, back 2002, that was still, you know, like Hugh Grant, like.
Right. Like Notting Hill, I remember it was upscale, but just to the north of Notting Hill, there was like a more kind of, well, to the south of Notting Hill, we went to Holland Park, which is very, like, very wealthy, posh area. That's kind of quintessentially like a movie thing of London, like
seemed
a movie
like
depiction
really,
of London.
Seems like you really did a good tour. You really got
then
the
like to the north. Let's see, to the north of Notting Hill is a more kind of working class area.
Yeah, I mean, I do know London.
The kind of like a lot of like the brutalist like tower blocks, like the Trellick Tower. Let's see, I do remember. Let's see, I went to some of the different museums. I went to
They're good.
The one at the Portrait Gallery, Trafalgar Square. I went to the British Museum.
Yeah, that's
I do remember seeing like a group of like of this kind of like. Oh, I was 16 at the time, and then there was like a, I remember like a large group of like up, very, very like upper class coded like schoolgirls who were maybe like a few years younger than me, like in their uniforms there. And I remember, and then let's see, I went to the Tate Modern, and I went by the Tower Bridge.
I mean, I go to London probably once a month, so I do know the place, but it's good. I'm good. You had a good time, obviously.
But it was such a brief trip. I went there. I mean, I went there
it
also
as
like
too a brief. Seems like you really got.
It was like 3 days. I went there also as like a really little kid in '89. But that's like,
well, yeah,
that,
well,
that's
yeah,
such a long
but,
time ago.
But I mean, 2002.
But one thing I will say about London is like when I went, so I went to New York for the first time, last year. And New York really feels like it feels like being in a movie about New York. One thing about London
I've
is
been
London,
to New York. It's the only place in America I've been to.
It feels like being in a movie of New York. But London, it has this amazing vibe once you're there. But movies do not capture, and photographs do not capture it at all. Which with New York, actually, I think it better does.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, you went to visit London in 2002. I have no fucking clue what London was like in 2002 because I was one. I mean, I assume it would have been sort of, you know, similar in layouts, but it, I mean, you know, yeah. You've been somewhere.
I really liked the brutalist kind of feeling of like the tube and the grittiness and energy of that. But I think we may have touched on this in the last show. Like there was the skyscraper boom. I think maybe on the last show you talked about like the kind of Victorian, like retro futuristic architecture.
Oh yeah,
and that's something that maybe should have happened but didn't.
Yeah, I mean, we've been on the decline for about, I mean, more than 100 years now, so it wouldn't surprise me.
And then I lived in the southwest in Plymouth for about five, maybe 6 months.
You actually lived here.
Yeah, and I didn't get to, so we were not allowed, it was weird because we were not allowed to go to school because we only had only a tourist visa status, which is weird. And but I lived in Plymouth, and Plymouth is like,
where do you go
more,
to school then?
I didn't go to school. I missed like a whole semester. So the summer was nice, and Plymouth is interesting. So it's very extremely homogenous. Like I'd say, like at least 95% English, which is unfathomable by California standards.
These are 2002 demographics.
It's probably changed.
Yeah,
and it's
very,
but
very
the
much changed.
The city is fairly it's in a beautiful natural location. But the city is fairly working class. It was destroyed in the Blitz in World War II, so it's a very, 1960s brutalist, kind of brutalist downtown.
Yeah, sounds
and then
about
I lived out in the suburbs, kind of in a nice area by the waterfront. And so we briefly lived there. And the summer is nice. There were beaches nearby and it was really beautiful, but it was tough, not being able to go to school. Then I do remember, the kind of music, Eurodance music, DJ Sammy was that kind of stuff was really popular back then.
This is 2002. So, I mean, you might as well be talking about the Victorian times.
I guess you probably would view that era the way I would view the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Because I was born in 01, so yeah, that's kind of how I view it. Although I do love a lot of media from the 2000s. So I love the show Skins. That was a British show from the 2000s. So and actually, my sisters are like that as well. So we have a lot of 2000s nostalgia because of just the age we are. But yeah, in terms of actually experiencing it, I mean, particularly the early 2000s. I mean, the late 2000s, I could maybe tell you a little bit, but the early 2000s just blank.
I think that was still left of some of the lingering of the Cool Britannia era of the 90s was still lingering.
Yeah. I mean, Tony Blair, you watch that 1997 advert, he just looks like the dodgiest guy ever.
Right.
And it just makes me wonder how the hell could that,
kind of like the British version of Bill Clinton.
Oh, he's worse, more like, I don't know if there's an exact American equivalent for Tony Blair. I think that JFK would have been, had he not died, he would be remembered like Blair as corrupt, sleazy. No, because Tony Blair isn't an actual sex pest like Bill Clinton.
Well, Blair seems nerdier than JFK.
He's a scumbag. Anyway, right. I'm bored of talking about Britain, believe it or not, because this place is just tragic.
Are you an Anglo-chauvinist? Are you invested in sort of Anglos as a people in diaspora? Are you sort of beyond that?
I'm kind of beyond that. And I had to delete this article because it numerous things about my doxing meant it couldn't be publicly shown. But it was an article saying there's nothing more liberating than accepting it's too late. And it's kind of true. If you think that, the share of the white population becoming a minority, is a done deal, it kind of makes you far less stressed. And, you just sort of take life as it comes. I've actually, in this period, found, reading ancient Greek philosophy quite comforting because, they weren't writing philosophy in, stable times. They, had to, they were sort of in certain places, the city-state would not like them and that they'd have to,
right.
They might be sort of put to death. Obviously, not that extreme here. But I have retreated inwards a little bit because I became disillusioned with the right as well. And I did talk about a bit more about this in my deleted article. Trump was a disappointment. He, he didn't respond really to the Charlie Kirk assassination at all. He kind of always would sort of appeal every court decision instead of just saying, the judges have made their ruling, now let him enforce it, which would be the Chad Andrew Jackson thing to do. Then he started the Iran war.
And I think the left has more, I mean, I don't support leftism, but I think the left has more phallic virility.
I just look at my time in the quote-unquote dissident right, and I just think, was that all for Peter Thiel and Zionists?
I mean, I think it's possible that Trump has done more, like, more damage than good, because he's done a tremendous amount of damage, but anything remotely positive he did will be easily reversed by Democratic administration.
Well, yeah, I'm happy that USAID has gone and stuff like that, but I just think, like they haven't solved, like, the Democrats are just going to get into power, back into power. They were kind of shell-shocked a bit with the kind of executive order blitz. But because Trump kind of got cold feet, really, he didn't cross the Rubicon, he splashed around, they were able to sort of regroup and change the narrative. And there was the, you know, what is it, like the Minneapolis sort of ICE protests. And Trump was a cuck, basically. He listened to Brooke Rollins and Susie Wills and all those little swamp creatures.
Right.
And the worst thing you can do is splash around in the Rubicon. Worst thing, because the alligators are going to get you. And that's what he did. You know, we were so close, you know, with Project 2025, you know, but they couldn't take the final step of dispensing, kind of declaring the state of exception. But anyway, so now I'm just disillusioned.
Do you see, like, with Anglos more broadly, do you see them more becoming kind of like a diaspora, like the Jewish diaspora, or do you favor more kind of the melting pot model?
I think
America did of the Ellis Islanders.
I mean, the thing is about Britain, and I think this actually goes a little bit the way explaining how America is as well, is that Britain was multiple nations. You know, Scotland, Wales, England, Ireland, who are very, like, particularly Ireland and England, and lesser so sort of, you know, the Celtic countries in England, are actually, like, they're very antagonistic towards each other. So, and also there's kind of class divides on top of that in England, which is sort of somewhat region, like, kind of north and south. There's that divide. And there's also
Do you think England,
like, a
has
class
more
divide within the south? So what I'm saying is that even when we were, like, you know, like 99.7% white, like we were prior to 1945, like, we were never really a cohesive nation. And you can sort of see the effects of that in America, because of course you have, you know, if you've read Albion's Seed,
right?
You know that America was never united, because they came from different parts of Britain.
So, like, the 1950s that the American right, a lot of them fetishized, that was kind of an artificial creation.
Yeah,
I mean, America, even though it was very white in the past, it was multicultural from, like, Albion Seed to these other waves of Europe.
Yeah, I mean, there was the first great replacement. Like, the first great replacement in America has already happened. Like, you know, Anglo-Americans
there had to be, like, a revisionist, like, history where, like, the founding fathers, they were, like, Anglo-chauvinists, but this revisionist history that somehow, like, Americans had to become, like, a new people.
Well,
and
I don't know. I mean, I think that they were we shouldn't let them off the hook. I mean, ultimately, America, not just America, like, Anglos generally are kind of made a sort of Faustian bargain to sort of become the global culture, and in doing so, kind of removing everything that sort of makes them distinctive as a people. And it just becomes the ultimate sort of deracinated,
right,
vanilla identity. And I think if you think about, you know, the America particularly is like an empire. And when I'm reading about, like, Rome, like, this isn't new. Like, you know, the Roman Republic, by the time of, you know, the Byzantines, was unrecognizable. It still called itself the Roman Empire. But once you're an empire, power, your empire becomes your only thing. And you will use any ideological tool to sort of do that. So, for instance, within Rome, it was Christianity. You know, they needed a new glue because the old one was failing. They couldn't incorporate all of these other groups. And in the West, it failed. But in the East, yeah, it survived for another 1,000 years. And you know, in America, you could say wokeness was kind of, I mean, you know, I don't know how long it'll last. I mean, although I read an article saying that, like, you know, if it's between wokeism and the sort of teal-verse transhumanism, there's not a guarantee that the latter is the lesser evil. In fact, it, you know, ultimately converges on the same sort of transhumanist nightmare. But what I'm saying is that empires, like, don't care about their founding group. They don't care about their founding religion or beliefs. They just become focused on doing whatever it takes to maintain.
But I think
power.
With, like, British people, like, the British are in the English particularly, like, they're sort of, like, in the imperial, like, core. So,
oh, yeah,
they're really beaten down and demoralized. Like, you get, like, if you meet Anglos from all these random countries, like Australia, or like South Africa, they have a more kind of like a cocky kind of alpha mindset, because that's like the nature of imperialism, is the people in the periphery, you sort of pump them up and then you beat down your own imperial.
Well,
core.
Yeah, but I didn't know this until I sort of started studying it. Like, the Romans started with ancient Greek colonies, you know, like Elia. You know, that's where the Eleatic school. That's like Parmenides and like philosophers like that, like Zeno of Elea and Melissus of Samos. They were like, you know, Greek. They were Greek colonies of the Italian peninsula. So really, I mean, you know, kind of America is Rome, and we're now, you know, the Greek, you know, Greece within.
Yeah, I mean,
the,
that's how it should be.
Now.
But you do have. But the thing is, like, you don't really have that. You should have that understanding. But you do have a lot of MAGA types. Actually, like, really detests you, like, Europe. I mean, it goes both ways. Like a lot of Brits and Europeans are kind of snooty towards Americans because they feel culturally superior, but they're resentful about having less political and economic power. But then you do have the kind of American chauvinism from Trump supporters, and it kind of goes both ways.
Yeah, I mean, we bat you with healthcare and you bat us with AC. It goes both ways.
Right, right.
I mean, it's just what you're used to, isn't it? I mean, I know it's more complicated than, but the perception in this country is that, you know, America, when it comes to healthcare, is like some sort of Dickensian dystopia, when people are like are left to die on the streets because they cannot pay the healthcare. Like, it's bad.
I guess, like, single payer does have
bad.
All this, like, single payer does have a lot of bureaucracy and hospitals that are very, like, that very utilitarian, where you don't get a private room. But I guess
it's
the lesser.
Well, I don't really have anything to compare it
towards
to.
Like, letting people, like, die in the street, that, like, in America.
Well, I don't really have much to compare the NHS to.
Like, maybe, I don't know, like, what's the best system, like, having healthcare as a public utility, but letting people go to private doctors, like, maybe that's the best case scenario.
I think a mixture. I think that, like, I think it's good that we have, so I think, like, the funding should all be public.
Right.
You should pay, like, a fixed percentage of your income for healthcare, and that's, like, ring-fenced for healthcare.
I think, I'm not 100% sure, I think the Swiss and Dutch healthcare system might be close to that, but I'm
not quite like
sure.
That. It's not quite like that, because that's a bit more private than what I'm talking about. The closest one to what I'm talking about is the Australian one. But anyway, so I'll just finish it. So basically, so you pay a percentage, and, like, your local authority is required to have at least half of their healthcare facilities public. And you're basically, and then you're given the choice, like, you can choose to, you know, just kind of go to the public hospitals free of charge. And if the private hospital is more efficient and can, you know, be better, and it actually costs the same as the procedure on the public system, that's covered by your sort of percentage levy still. But then, you know, if it's more expensive, if there's like premium extras, you pay a little bit more on top of that. But what I think this system would be good at is providing like a benchmark for like, how much should this cost on the public system? So you know if private, you know, private healthcare facilities are ripping you off. If I was designing a healthcare system from scratch, that's sort of how I'd do it. But yeah.
Do you have thoughts on how the UK having a very rigid class system compared to a continental Europe plays out in politics and society?
Well, actually, I think America has a very nasty class system. It's so
in a
nasty
different way. Well, I guess
because it's able to pretend that it's meritocratic.
Exactly.
I actually don't believe in equality of opportunity for two main reasons. The first one is that it's impossible without totalitarianism in terms of abolishing the family. That's what you'd have to do if you wanted true equality of opportunity. So realistically, it's impossible. Even in terms of like, you know, ideals and, hypothetical case of when that happened, all that would happen is that because you don't choose your IQ, you don't choose how naturally gifted you are. But what, you know, would do is that it would give people who are naturally gifted a real feeling that because they had quote unquote equality of opportunity in a sort of, you know, collective parenting style system, that they really are better than other people. And so in two ways, I think equality of opportunity is a bad ideal. My thing is I just want security for all classes. So the lower class, they live in comfort, they have security, they live well. And the upper class, of course, you know, better, more wealthy, slightly bigger houses.
And they receive from the lower classes.
Pardon?
They receive from the lower classes.
Oh, fucking hell. Yes, of course, you were going to have to put that in. I'm making a serious point.
If that happened in England, like, it would be more heightened because of the class system having a more of a genetic component. So I think it heightens
overstating it a little bit. I mean, it's funny when you're not from a place, you can kind of take things you've heard.
Well, no, seriously. I mean, I think in England, like there's more of a genetic difference between the upper and lower class.
Yes, I think you're right, and that's part of why I think that English people are very, very bad at siding with their own.
They can't have, like, I think nationalism works
in
France because there's more class. Obviously France has class warfare.
Country,
but there's a sense, like, in France, I think, like, even if there's economic class warfare, the French working class and upper class are maybe, like, they see themselves as the same people. But I think Britain has this thing where it's like the working class and the upper class are two different, like, almost ethnic groups. But I still...
And of course there are reasons for that. I mean, you know, Norman and Anglo-Saxon, aren't they? But
I think the working class is more Celtic.
Celtic and Anglo-Saxon, and the aristocracy was more sort of Norman-French traditionally. But, you know, there are exceptions to that.
But I think the American... Well, the British... class system is flawed, but I still think it's a lesser of evils than what America has. Like, I think
I would agree.
Like, I find American, like, our class culture to be just totally revolting.
Yeah.
Just such a system, because the built-in, like, hypocrisy, and I also think, like, blank slateism,
yeah,
the idea everyone is born genetically equal,
yeah,
is used to justify capitalism and extreme income inequality.
I mean, I don't think there is anything fair about a system of quote unquote equality of opportunity, because nobody is, because, you know, some people are born, you know, beautiful, they're born beautiful, healthy, and intelligent, and some people are born ugly, stupid and disabled. I mean,
there's
nothing more false than all men are created equal. But in the complete inverse from the American view is what I believe because human beings are unequal of birth. That means that actually, in terms of their social standing, they should be more equal because nobody chose, what body or what mind they'd be born into. So.
Do you think there's a big class disparity in like physical appearance in the UK?
I don't know. A little bit. You can sometimes tell. Particularly with accent. Accent's a very big tell. You can just tell if, particularly a girl, if she's been to private school. You just know. It's not a bad thing.
I guess from your accent, you sound pretty middle class.
I am. I mean, we're not like. How would you sort of describe my family? My family was. Of course, we're talking about like which side. But we are middle class. I wouldn't say upper middle class, but sort of. Of course, middle class post war means something different to middle class in the Victorian times when somebody who was sort of new money, who was like a ultra rich capitalist, was still middle class because they weren't aristocrats. But now, now I'd say that, because the aristocracy is sort of so insignificant and kind of is sort of intertwined with sort of capital, business entrepreneurship. It's so tied in that, I'm middle class.
I think in the American context, people envy and resent old money more, but I think like the absolute worst people in the United States are not people who come from like old money or inherent wealth, but the kinds of people they're often who are middle class, but who ride up the corporate ladder and become CEOs. People are the absolute worst.
But I mean, the American aristocracy, the kind of WASP, New England types, were absolute traitors, to their group. Really, I mean, the British aristocracy is bad, but the American WASPs just sold their souls.
Well, that's true.
They sold their souls out of existence. The British aristocracy still exists. The kind
so
of
you say like
aristocracy,
yeah, like people really. like the Bush family.
Yeah, the kind of people who would speak in the transatlantic accent, the sort of very anglicised. They would come across as sort of very English almost. I mean the transatlantic accent sounds kind of English. And that group's kind of gone basically. But it was their own fault because they decided, because they were only really interested in making money in the kind of universalist creed. And I guess
America's lacked like a real real aristocracy. It's always been like even the people, those old money WASPs, like who's supposed to be aristocrats, like they still sort of behaved like the worst traits of the merchant caste.
Yeah,
and I don't know like if America can build a better caste system. Like I think we're kind of stuck, and I think AI is going to create this new money class of people who could end up being a lot worse. And We're kind of screwed as far as our class.
Suppose to cite your favorite woman of all time, Cher Horowitz is an American aristocrat.
Oh, yeah. the character.
Yeah, well, the character Cher Horowitz in Clueless is an aristocrat.
Well, that's actually the actress or the character?
The character in Clueless.
I think the interesting thing is I think she's playing a different. I think her character and the actress. The actress is more kind of old money, more assimilated. I think she's trying to play a more stereotypical, newer money character than her actual background.
Well, maybe it's interesting because maybe that's what it would have come across in the 90s. But looking back now,
Because I grew up in that kind of upper class coded, but I, even though I wasn't part of that, I grew up adjacent to them in LA, and I got that character makes me think of a very specific kind of like archetype I had like a crush on
how much of Vapor Island was directly based on your life?
That's for me to know and for the audience
Okay, you know, you don't have to reveal. Just a question which you can decline to answer. That's fine. It is. Vapor Island was so funny, though. I just like how you sort of forgot there was a story by the second half. It was just like, how do we squeeze in as much of Robert Stark's fetish as possible? into a certain number of pages. But, you know, but some, like, I mean, obviously, you know, the golden shower machines, not really my taste, but I mean, some of it I did find hot. So, I kind of like the kind of, you know, it's sort of like, what is it, the name? Wendy is like kind of, Xenia on the top from GoldenEye, James Bond film.
Oh, yeah.
I just found it hot. So yeah.
Have you encountered like that kind of archetype?
Not somebody who's wanted to do that to me, I'm afraid to say not. Which is a shame, and I hope to discover that those women are not a fantasy and that they do really exist at some point in my life. But at the moment, I am unsure.
You should go to like that speaker's corner in London with a megaphone and start chanting that ideology.
Well, what? It's not my ideology. I guess it's funny how your ideology is like, it's so like transparently just your fetish. It's quite funny. I mean, I used to kind of think, like, you know, kind of moral fact about it, but it is something almost sort of quite sort of endearing and charming about it.
You prefer it to the Walt Bismarck thing about the
Holy
Romano? Yes,
100%. 100%. The thing is, what about Walt Bismarck, he didn't used to be this grotesque and disgusting. I feel like his sort of, like, you know, talking about his sort of, like, how, like, he wants to sort of, you know, kind of dominate women. That wasn't something that when I first met him he was all about. I feel like it was almost like a reaction to you to kind of out.
Oh right.
Grotesque you, but just like the dominant version. That like.
Oh,
male
were you
dom
around?
Version.
But I mean, his music, like his I think you can have that duality because his music is very, like his Disney songs are very like over the top romantic.
Oh, it's just. Yeah, right, yeah. I mean, I was sort of pretending to be shocked and outraged with you, but fundamentally it's harmless and there's something a bit charming about it.
Walt thinks my views are actually like safe kink.
Well, you know what? I don't really have any sympathy for the kind of safe, horny, safe kink rhetoric. I just think that dominant men are. Well, they're just sociopathic chads and they don't need, I mean, anything to sort of, you know, kneecap them in the smallest possible way is...
Do you think leftism or the right wing be more effective at sort of like kneecapping those types of men?
Well, this is where I don't know. I mean, this is where I'm genuinely torn. I wrote on notes a sort of thing of... a kind of dissident right version of Animal Farm where the chads are the pigs. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did.
Well, yeah, because I think that is what would happen if all Gentile straight white men launched a revolution against the woke, right? It literally would...
It wouldn't last
that long because they tried to incorporate back in other groups because they'd actually... resent each other as much as they sort of resent the woke now. And so it'll be dominated
kind of,
by the pigs.
You get similar dichotomy. I think with the left is they pump up women a lot who are power bottoms, and then the women who are power bottoms, they empower they empower the Chads, and then, but I think with the right wing, they just outright empower the Chads, but they kind of use the lower status males as kind of pawns, and they tell them that they're victims. So you, I think on the gender power dynamics and the power hierarchies, you end up at the same place. You ironically end up at the same place.
Yeah, the
whether you have feminism
submissive
or right wing.
Male is always at the bottom of the
exactly.
Path. Always.
And I don't think there's like a political ideology solution. Maybe that's just how human socialization works out.
Meh. Okay. Well, maybe we just need to retreat into AI porn. Maybe that's the over. I don't know.
So totally off the wall question, but do you pronounce the term massage like in your accent? Would you say massage?
Yeah, assage. Yeah.
Massage.
Yeah. What?
You say massage or massage?
Massage.
I'm like really getting obsessed with that pronunciation.
Okay.
And I think I asked this guy who came on from New Zealand about massage.
Okay.
Cause there's like, do you ever watch these like ASMR channels?
With
like, they do like head massage, like in.
Yeah, you just admit that you watch porn.
No, it's ASMR on YouTube.
Yeah, it's softcore pornography.
Well, it can be a man, or like an Indian guy, or like an old Filipino guy, because like
you can be homosexual.
Because like you get like a young Australian guy, like a young kind of Australian Chad, and he's like in the Philippines, and he's like, "Good day, mate. How much for a head massage, mate?" And then like the old Filipino guy is like, "Oh, you know the best massage.
Happy ending. Yeah, this sounds like a gay porno. Anyway.
It's ASMR, there's nothing sexual
okay,
about
if
it, but
if you say so.
Like, do you ever get ASMR tingles?
Not really.
We're at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, John Arcto, do you have anything that you would like to add or plug?
No, I mean, I think we covered it all, including the most important thing of all, which is, when talking to Robert Stark, which is that what is the likelihood of creating a society where an upper class blonde 18-year-old Jewess gets to be eaten out by a 40-year-old working class goy schmuck who looks and acts a lot like Robert Stark. I mean, that is the litmus test issue. That is the Schmittian friend-enemy formula. You know, closer to making that happen and, you know, further away from making that happen.
John Arcto, it's been a great show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you. All right. Cheers.
Thank you for tuning in. You can follow Robert Stark on his Substack at robertstark.substack or on his website at starktruthradio.com. See you next time.